just do. Need a little help. Said boy.
One of the things that's so interesting, Dr. Albert, is we at least, well, let's take this for example. When Bill Clinton was president, he's looking at what was happening in Bosnia. And he was saying, we need to send some troops over there to help restore peace. And the Republicans said, we don't need to be spreading ourselves so thin, sending our troops all over the world trying to keep peace. We need to let these people just do what they're going to do in their parts of the world. But apparently both the Republicans were thinking about what was in America's best interest. I'm assuming President Clinton was thinking about what was in America's best interest, even though he did talk about the humanity of what was going on in Bosnia, the slaughtering, the genocide, et cetera. Moved a little slow when it came to Somalia, moved very slow when it came to Somalia.
In Rwanda.
In Rwanda, yeah. And George Herbert Walker Bush kind of, George Bush kind of picked up. But I'm thinking, okay, if both sides are saying we have America's best interest at heart, with every decision we make, how is it that they have such different views as to what is in America's best interest?
This is what I try to tell my students, and I try to stay objective in the classroom. I don't let them know which way I swing. I try not to let them know which way I swing. I think that's important. Both sides, Republicans and Democrats, want what's in America's best interest when it comes to domestic politics, when it comes to international politics. Both sides want America to thrive and strive to be the greatest country on earth. Both parties, however, have different mindsets and conceptions on how to get to that end goal. And both sides have slightly different understandings of what that end goal would be. What makes America the best regime? What is in America's best regime? Best interest is in different, according to both of the political parties, at different times. When it comes to foreign policy, there's not a set Republican Party foreign policy versus a set Democrat foreign policy. Both sides operate under the same understanding of our grand strategy, which has been the same since post-World War II, something called deep engagement. I won't go too far into what that means, but it pretty means protecting our power worldwide and make sure we never go into World War II again, while protecting states from any type of upheaval that will affect America's interests and that may be of a great human rights value to their country as well, and to support some kind of free trade, all again to benefit the United States. When you decide to invade or send your troops into engagement with another foe, you have to consider, as I was saying earlier, not just the international ramifications for that. Who are you going to pull in? Is this engagement going to be a long time lasting? Is it going to pull in another great power? We have to be careful about the consequences of other states, other actors. What are they going to do? Are terrorists going to come in and get involved? Is this going to ostracize one population? But at the same time, you have to, as I was saying, understand your political base at home. And at different times, each political party will support invading a country or preemptive airstrikes or retaliatory airstrikes or sanctions, not just for the international ramifications, but that it'll either ostracize or propel more voters to their party in the next political election. Mm-hmm. So it's very complicated. Both of them will phrase the actions in the term of American interest or greater humanity's interest, which in turn benefits the United States, depending on how you frame and message it. Mm-hmm. We have to remember, unfortunately, even when we deal with people's lives, when we're talking about issues of war and peace, we are always considering what's in America's interest first. And then my students say, well, isn't that egotistical or isn't that arrogant or unfair when we're the most powerful actor in the stage? No, it's not unfair. Or it's not, you know, I want to be the best at what I do. I strive to be the best at what I do. I try to be humble when I achieve success. And if I'm not humble, my mom or my wife will bring me down in a second and make sure I stay that way, or my boss will. But I want to be the best. And, I tell my students, which one of you in here does not want to be your best? Doesn't want to be the best. Mm-hmm.
But your best.
Be your best.
Yes.
Everybody wants that, and it's no different. You know, I want my family to be the best. You know, I want to have a good family. I want to have a proper income for my family to sustain my family and make sure we don't go without. And yes, I want to go out there and get what I can to achieve that. And that's the way countries operate as well. They have that same basic understanding of what it takes to thrive, because unfortunately, all of us operate under the idea that, you know, if we're not getting it, somebody else is getting it. And in countries, when you're talking about countries in international relations, we operate under a very Hobbesian understanding of the world. Thomas Hobbes, the great English philosopher, who says, you know, life in the state of nature is poor, nasty, solitary, brutish, and short. We are alone in the woods, and everything's trying to kill us. So the only way that we can maintain and guarantee our survival is to be first, be stronger, and be prepared to do that to them. And on the international stage, when you're governing 320 million citizens, you have to calculate that theoretically, tactically, strategically, are you willing to be the president or the political party that risk America's 320 million citizens and don't go to war or do go to war because of how you calculated or perceived what's happening somewhere else? You have to take that. There's not been a president that hasn't gone gray without hair dye in 100 days of office because of that. When you think of the gravity of the situation, that's what I tell my students. I don't care if you respect whoever the president is or whoever the political party is. You respect the office and the, I don't want to say sacredness, but the awe-ness, the awesomeness of the office of the presidency, because it is the most powerful office in the history of the world, with the most awesome military force that the world could ever think to have. And you have the capability, literally the capability, to take every country off the face of the world through nuclear tactical and strategic stripes, from bombers, from submarines, from naval fleets, from everything. We have the only truly blue water fleet in the world. Nobody else matches our naval capabilities, not to the extent that we have. China's trying, but they're not going to get there. We won't let them get there. They're decades away from it. But that's what we have to consider every time we act. And both political parties use that to their advantage when they see fit. So sometimes it's, no, we don't want to do that. They might actually want to do that, but they know by saying no, they'll get more voters to agree with them. At other times they say, yes, let's go in there and tech, because they know that the voters will believe that that's the good thing to do. Mm-hmm. Now, they also consider, as I said before, the international ramifications, but they consider everything. So often, like, to go to war in Iraq, at first, everybody needs to remember the United States was around invading Iraq in 2003. There was a huge rally around the flag effect. You know, the use of authorization of use of military force signed in 2002 gave the president the right to invade, to attack, to defend anywhere in the world if there was any hint of terrorism that would be against the United States' interests. Only two senators voted against that or did not vote for that. I believe it's two. So that's 98 out of 100 senators that said yes. And now every time the president acts, all the president, no matter who it is, has to say is, this is in regards to that 2002 authorization of use of military force. That's an amazing amount of power to give the president. And that's outside of declaring war. They took that need away from the United States Congress by saying, we give the president the right, the use of to authorize force in these areas. Now, Congress can always use its War Powers Act to reduce that to 90 days, but they never have used that. I doubt they ever will.
And I wonder sometimes if they ever regret that decision. We've heard some people doing a little bit of backpedaling since then. But when we come back, we're talking certainly war powers, but from the perspective of what our American senators decided, what our congressmen decided a number of years ago. Well, as you mentioned, our presidents and our political parties are thinking about not only international ramifications, but home ramifications. What's going to happen here? And of course, we know we got primaries taking place all across the country as people are gearing up for the general elections. And one of the big questions that a lot of people are asking is, what's going to happen in California? We got a Republican and a Democrat who will be running for governor in November. And a lot of people are saying, As goes California, so goes the rest of the nation. Could you weigh in on that for us when we come back?
Sure will.
All right, everybody. Our guest, Dr. Craig Albert, and I will be right back.